You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 24th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Coburn, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, on his book, The Spoils of War, Power, Profit, and the American War Machine. And later on in the program, we will be having Ken Klippenstein on to discuss his latest piece in The Intercept on Saudi-Russian oil collusion. Last night, Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, which included hitting cities with airstrikes and shelling, and tanks rolling across the border. Reports of Russian cyber attacks on Ukraine have also been trickling in. The number of casualties is still unknown. However, last night, Ukraine's Interior Ministry told CNN that hundreds have been killed. This morning, the Ukrainian government now says at least 40 Ukrainian soldiers have died. Still waiting for more accurate numbers, but it's gut-wrenching regardless. Oil prices have soared as a result to $8 a barrel. Is that right? As Russia is one of the top three oil producers in the world. We'll be talking a bit more about that later with Ken Klippenstein. Joe Manchin has reportedly indicated that he will get behind past anti-labor lawyer J. Michelle Childs, who Clyburn has been pushing for the Supreme Court. So I think she's the favorite now, folks. Two of the prosecutors leading the Manhattan DA's criminal investigation into Trump have stepped down after Cy Vance exited the position and Alvin Bragg ascended. The probe appears to be on life support now. Two European pharma companies, Sanofi and GSK, have developed a vaccine that they claim is 100% effective against severe disease from COVID and hospitalizations. Two doses for this one. And lastly, Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau has ended the use of the Emergencies Act, which allowed him to freeze the bank accounts of the right-wing trucker convoy protests after outcry. Good move there. Yep. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, Bradley. Bradley!
All right. What happens when I do 10 things at once?
Yes, yes. And don't blame Bradley, but that was a little funny. Little levity to start the show because obviously last night was devastating evening. We can just get right into it because there's a lot of news to talk about. Peace in Europe has been broken. Russia has attacked Ukraine, invaded Ukraine, and it's not just the peacekeeping troops that Putin kind of like laughably claimed he'd stick to. He announced a special operation, and right after, it was just an invasion. So the AP has reported, and videos have shown explosions in the capital, in Mariupol, in the southeast, in Kharkiv, all over the country, in different locations. And the invasion happened not just in the south, not just in the east, but in the north as well, which indicates that Belarus is likely assisting in these efforts. And the north doesn't really have, from my understanding, the Russian-speaking concentration that the other more bordered regions do. So an invasion that's that targets those regions is a lot more of a larger scale situation. It's unconfirmed that Belarus is assisting, but it just seems that way as of right now. So Zelensky went to address the nation last night. He said that Russia had targeted military infrastructure, particularly air defenses, and also went after border guards in the Donbass region. And Putin's whole claim here the underpinning of what he's saying is that this is a denazification effort, and he's trying to echo back to past World War II efforts to denazify Germany. But it's really more akin to when the Bush administration stole that term, debothification. It's a pretext for imperialism and a pretext for occupation. And, you know, it's like when you say there are some really, there are some bad actors in like this nationalist anti-Russian factions in Ukraine, in the military, etc. But he's using that as a pretext for imperialism.
Yeah,
a
warrant for an invasion.
Right. And that's just kind of like much more like Saddam is a bad guy and this is why we have to start a war than it is the like the World War II valor that he's trying to harken back to. And it's just the liberation rhetoric of imperialists. And he's also harkening back to World War II, I believe, as a bit of a threat to kind of say to Europe, say to the West, don't forget the sacrifices that we made, which is true. I mean, the West has largely tried to erase the fact that 20 million Soviets died fighting the Nazis. But it's a bastardization of that effort in order to justify imperialism. The reality is, as I mentioned, it's just brute imperialism. Their justification for this act of war, the denazification part, and then also Ukraine potentially joining NATO, now it just really rings hollow, of course, because they've abandoned diplomacy and they've embraced violence. And like talking about that at this point, it's just we're past that. Here is a clip, some footage that the New York Times has verified showing Russian helicopters circling near Kiev and firing directly at an airport outside of it.
Штук 20 пролетіло. Не видно українського герба. Точно російські.
Раз, два, три, чотири, п'ять, шість, сім, вісім.
Та слышиш.
Вау, окей. So that's just a bit of a
Ух ты ж, ёлки-палки.
No, it's okay. It's just a restarted. Yeah. So that's just some of the footage, and we're seeing a lot of similar footage coming out about this as well. As I mentioned, to headline the show, more than 40 Ukrainian soldiers confirmed by the Ukrainian government have been killed. Dozens more were wounded. That number is going to increase throughout the day. So
yeah, they hit a lot of like sort of airport targets and some other military type targets, and yeah, people
and apartment
died.
Complexes too. I mean, there's footage of complexes. I mean, again, this is like the fog of war.
Yeah, it's hard to know like what footage is what.
Right. I mean, that's why I went with the New York Times footage because they verify it. But we're still getting a full grasp of what's happening and the death toll and the damage. But it was widespread throughout the country think the biggest point.
And I saw enough, you know, just based on like a live stream that's just always up, you know, you could on YouTube, you can search blank city live stream and you can just look at a live stream on that city. And there's one for a Kiev. And I watched it really sped up, but around the time the shelling started and it was like grainy footage and traffic hitting the streets and people starting to flee. And what it reminded me of was, back in like 2003 or whenever, when I had a TV in my room and I was ready to watch the invasion of Iraq, and I was kind of like, you know, pro American on that thing, and I watched it and I was like, huh, this doesn't seem great, and it's horrible. And this is I felt the exact same way like last night watching people flee this stuff, and I confess I wasn't expecting this to happen. That was in large part wishful. And it's horrible that Putin's doing this. I do think like condemning that, and we'll get into this with Coburn maybe. Yeah. Like he'll have great context on that. Like I am only interested in doing that in the like in the context of a wider conversation of how we've got up to this point and how the people of Ukraine have been used by as a
chair. Proxy.
And I'm fully welcome to emphasize Putin as the bad actor here, but I want a full conversation of that, as opposed to like saying, are you secretly for Putin if you bring up like the IMF or something like that, right? Like, and I again, this is the act of aggression. This is awful, and it's one of the crimes of the century.
Yep. It's terrifying. Let's just get a little bit more footage before we get to Andrew. This is live on CNN. This was the scene as well. You can hear also in Kiev here. Clearly, there were some explosions going off in the background.
Resist. Oh, I tell you what, I just heard a big bang right here behind me. I thought we shouldn't have done the live shot here. There are big explosions taking place. Yeah. In Kiev right now. I can't see where they're taking place from this vantage point here on top of the roof of the hotel in central Kiev. And I can't explain what they are, but I heard 4 or 5 explosions a few moments ago. I don't know whether our viewers or whether you in the studio there could hear what I just heard. You could.
I mean, that's terrifying because, I mean, clearly they should not have done the shot there, but they were trying to get a nice shot, I guess. But that's just some of it. And I encourage people to look up. I mean, you can see interviews of Ukrainians who have had to flee to Poland talking about why they've had to do so. Poland is going to experience an influx in refugees, and the U.S. has claimed that the troops that they've sent there will assist in that effort, but the scope of it is going to be unfolding. And at this point, primarily, I think we also should be emphasizing that refugee support should be one of our top priorities. And I also just want to make sure that we plug that we had Jack Crosby, who writes for the AM Quickie and, part of he's our colleague. Yeah. He's writing for Rolling Stone, and you guys should check out his piece there. It's entitled "On a Thursday Morning in Kharkiv, Ukraine Wakes to War." I want to read just one part of what he wrote about here, and you guys can read the rest of the article. "The morning was a nightmare for every other person living in Ukraine. No one slept much last night. Russian and Belarusian troops are fighting with the Ukrainian military in the north of the country." Okay, so that confirms it a bit more. "Missiles or airstrikes hit Odessa, Kharkiv, Kiev." That's a little tough for me. Kramatorsk, Mariupol, and other cities. "When the sun rose, myself and my traveling partner, a reporter for Foreign Policy, left our apartment and set off on foot to reach the Kharkiv Palace, where we had been told that the major media outlets were staying. I received a tip that a higher-up at the cable news network had informed Moscow of the media presence at the palace, perhaps as some kind of assurance that it would not be hit by missile strikes. That seemed like as good a bet as any." We're thinking of Jack right now.
Horrible.
Horrible. And everybody else who's there.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Andrew Coburn, who will talk a bit about his book and also the crisis that we're facing right now. We are back, and we are joined now by Andrew Coburn, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, on his book, The Spoils of War, power prophet in the American war machine. Andrew, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, good to be with you.
I mean, it what a day to have you on. We've had you booked for a while, but this is going to be an important discussion, I think, because, you know, I want to get into your book in a bit, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Well, you know, like most sentient people, I think I'm horrified that they actually, Putin went ahead and did this. I mean, I can, you know, I've read his statements and they have a certain sort of internal logic to them. I mean, yes, it's true that, you know, the U.S. had been pushing to expand NATO, pushing against Russia, you know, since the 90s. It's true that, you know, that the Minsk Accords had never been implemented and so on and so forth. But to launch, you know, a major war on the basis of all that, to, you know, to do the thing that every single one of his spokesmen have been saying for weeks, months, that they would never do, invade Ukraine, makes, you know, he's made fools of Russia, of the Russian officials, of not to mention everyone who sort of said, yes, that sounded sensible. They weren't going to invade. So, you know, there's no talking our way around the fact that this is a colossal disaster.
I saw your piece in The Spectator, I believe, asking if Biden would be able to channel JFK in the way that he resisted the thunderous war drums during the Bay of Pigs. What's your estimation of how Biden has responded to Putin's aggression?
Well, clearly, you know, they guessed correctly what, or, you know, learned, or however, what Putin was going to do. But they made every effort to sort of make sure he did it, I think. You know, they made no effort to sort of to give him the guarantees, which, you know, weren't, I don't see why they were there so painful. I mean, everyone sort of knows that Ukraine won't be in, well, maybe now it's changed. Ukraine won't be in NATO. I feel they, you know, they could have found ways to head this off, but clearly not interested in doing it. You know, so I thought the situation might be like it was in 1962 when neither Kennedy nor Khrushchev really wanted a war, were, you know, very determined not to have one, and therefore were sufficiently in control of things to make sure that didn't happen. And as I said in that Spectator piece, you know, Kennedy was prepared to make a secret deal with Khrushchev on the condition it kept secret, to withdraw American missiles that were, in the Russian view, settlers threatening Russia from Turkey and indeed Italy, in return for the Russians taking their missiles out of Cuba. And clearly Biden was not interested in offering Putin any such concession. I think that one of the problems is that if he had, or maybe he did, offer Putin a sort of secret concession that they'd make sure Ukraine didn't join NATO. But, you know, they offered that, they made that commitment back in 1991, when they told the Russians that NATO would not expand beyond Germany. And, you know, that's absolutely clear now, you know, that we have documentary evidence that that commitment was indeed made, but it wasn't made in, you know, it wasn't, the actual commitment wasn't in writing. So I think Putin's view would have been, well, you've made us verbal promises before and you broke them, so why should we believe you now?
I mean, it seems silly that, like, I feel it's a bit revisionist history to be like, well, it wasn't in writing, so it wasn't an official concession. It seems to be changing history in that regard. At the time, my understanding is that that was understood. My one question to you is, do we take Putin's word at face value that kind of concession from the Biden administration would have even deterred him, given the intensity of his rhetoric and then followed by such actions?
Well, you know, it's an open question. I mean, it might have, you know, a little while ago. I mean, remember, this has been a, you know, the recent history of this is not being much explained. You know, the whole You know, going back to, I mean, it's kind of a pretty sort of well-trampled topic now, but, you know, the whole events in 2014, when the overthrow of the, you know, he was an elected president of Ukraine. I mean, good reasons not to like him, President Yukanovich, but then the, you know, the civil war that broke out, the secession of the eastern districts in the Donbass, the Minsk Accords, which, you know, could have been a proper settlement. But I think for internal Ukrainian reasons, and we can talk about that, how, you know, Zelensky has been under unrelenting assault since he took power from the people he soundly defeated, who accused him of being soft on Russia and so forth. You know, that tentative peace deal in 2015 was never implemented. So it led to this. I mean, I'm not in any way, shape or form trying to make excuses for Putin, but I can sort of see how this came about.
Right. Well, I mean, we're just diagnosing it. I think like in the fog of war and in some of these heightened times, there's a tendency to maybe pick sides in an argument or you know, say ascribe some sort of prescription to why something happened as opposed to it being quite multifaceted.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's very little examination here of both the internal politics in Ukraine and the internal politics in Russia. I thought it was in Moscow. I thought it was very interesting in his address the other day. He basically said Ukraine was all the fault of the communists, that Lenin and then Stalin and then Khrushchev, you know, by creating, in his terms, creating Ukraine, which he claimed didn't exist before, really created the current situation. And it's worth remembering that actually the communists have become a bit of a problem for Putin in the recent period. I mean, they did quite well in the last elections. Their vote went up significantly. And between them and the ultra-nationalists and maybe the liberals that we hear so much in the American press. But, he's facing political problems at home. And his plank is, you know, I'm the one who stands up for Russia. I'm the strong man. You know, I think all foreign policy is about domestic politics. I always believe that, and I certainly argue that in my book. And I think that's, you know, if you understand what brought Putin to this present situation, present position, comes from that, from his position at home, which he felt had to do with.
Yeah, I mean, let's dive a bit more into your book then and past current events while still, I think, connecting it to it, because you talk about sanctions in your book. And I think there's very little literacy in the United States about what sanctions entail and what the breadth of what they can cause, right? You can do something that's a bit more targeted, like Biden is doing right now. Is that effective enough? Or you can do very broad ones that end up really, really hurting the people of the country as opposed to the leadership and they basically pass it off to them. Talk a little bit about the role of sanctions in American foreign policy in particular over the past century or so, and how that's a bit of a that's sort of a military effort while also not having the oversight of one, not that it has that much oversight, but if you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. Well, you called it right. It is, but I mean, it is our principal sort of offensive instrument. I mean, akin to an instrument of war, to which we've become increasingly addicted for various reasons. I mean, reviewing it quickly, I date them back to, modern era, you date them back to Cuba in 1960, or in 61, when Kennedy imposed sanctions. And I think we've just had some documents released giving the original sort of policy argument for doing them, which was to produce hunger and desperation among the Cuban people, leading to the overthrow of the regime. And, for a while, they did broad-based sanctions. That really changed. In the late 1980s, there was a whole new sort of view from inside the sanctions bureaucracy. They thought of ways to make them targeted. Originally, it was in connection with the war on drugs, to use them, you know, like it's almost the same language as, you know, the whole drone warfare approach, precision strikes against high value targets. And in fact, it's, to me, it seems like the same mentality. By taking out key people, you can achieve your objective. And the sort of the lesson, obviously, from then till now is it doesn't do anything of the kind, both with drones, as a matter of fact, and with targeted sanctions, in that, you know, you target some banker or a trade official, whoever, you know, the specially designated, the SDN list, specially designated national list, is thousands and thousands of names long now. You can look it up on the Treasury website. But I've seen no sign of, I cannot find a case where it's actually, you know, achieved the stated objective. So not on the war on drugs. We have as many drugs coming in as ever. Not in terms of, you know, I don't know, destroying the Syrian regime. And I can guarantee you not in terms of bringing down Putin.
Well, I mean, is there a difference in your opinion in sanctions levied against a large and wealthy nation like Putin that does have resources, as opposed to, say, the draconian sanctions against Saddam Hussein, for example, and nations like Iraq, or even like Cuba, where the United States can kind of flex its muscle to a degree?
Yes, absolutely. It's a good question. You know, we were able to embargo, you know, have very cruel, harsh sanctions against Iraq for 12 years on the correct assumption it didn't really make much difference to us. I mean, it kept up the price of oil a bit, probably, which was fine by the oil, was fine by the oil companies, and all the people they pay off here in Washington. Otherwise, it didn't make much difference. The difference, I think, of sanctioning Russia is, you know, obviously, you know, as we've been hearing a lot about in recent weeks, the Europe depends on Russia to keep warm. I mean, for its 40% of its gas comes from hugely dependent on energy for Russia. It'll put up the price of oil for everyone, for you and me and everyone else in the world, quite sharply. I mean, not many people realize that at the moment, Russia is our second largest source of foreign oil. It'll put up the price of grain. Russia is a huge grain exporter, supplying, for example, wheat to Egypt to make the bread in Egypt. That's a sort of staple of the Egyptian diet. So when the price of bread goes up in Egypt, you tend to have riots. And I confidently expect that's what will be happening. Huge amounts of various very important commodities come from Russia. So titanium, for example, for the U.S. aircraft industry. So in a way, by sanctioning something like Russia, as you said, to a certain degree, we're sanctioning ourselves. And that's the problem with this kind of weapon. The other point about sanctions is that they're sticky. They're very hard to take off. You know, easy to impose, stroke of the pen. The Treasury, OFAC, Office of Foreign Assets Control, very powerful bureaucracy, issues its orders. But then you say, okay, no, it's fine. We sort of forgive you now, and we're not having the sanctions anymore. But because of the way they operate, removing them doesn't have any effect. That's why the Iranian deal, why the Iranians are so reluctant to sign up again. Because they said last time you promised to lift sanctions, and they didn't really go away. That's what's happening very tragically, and unfortunately it's going to vanish from the news now because of what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening in Afghanistan. You know, right. We're still sanctioning Afghanistan. And the Treasury says, oh no, we issued special licenses so that, you know, you can send humanitarian goods, but it doesn't work because the banks won't handle, you know, the banking system in Afghanistan's broken down because of our sanctions and your foreign banks won't handle transactions to Afghanistan. I mean,
and they have an issue of just not having enough currency in the nation. And so, like, right. Just...
Yeah. It's sanctioned. You know, yeah. It's printed in Poland or somewhere. And, right. You know, and it's sanctioned. So, you know, it's a horrible weapon, sanctions, I think, because its consequences are so badly ill, they're so whimsically applied, and their consequences are very badly understood.
And proportional to the nation's wealth and power, I would imagine, as well. You can see what's happening in Afghanistan versus what you talk about is going to likely be the consequences of these sanctions against Russia. Although my other question to you, and not to focus too much on this, it's just on everybody's mind. I want to talk more about your book as well. But what is your sense of what can be done outside of sanctions? Because I'm no one here and is in favor of military response from the United States.
Well, yes, I mean, that's a very difficult question.
Yeah.
I think the obloquy of that's being showered on Russia quite rightly now, on Putin for doing this, has to be sustained. We cannot be understanding of this. I think what will happen is, he's determined to destroy as much of Ukraine's military potential as possible. You see he's attacking all these various airfields, like the airfield outside of Kiev, ports along the Black Sea that he claimed were going to be getting ready for the use by NATO forces. I think in the end, what he'll hold on to will be the, again, as this is not an original thought, the entire provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk, which, is what they've been claiming all along, which they only held part of, and then is settled back. That has the advantage for him, as far as I understand it, that makes it impossible for Ukraine to join NATO, because I think it's in the NATO, whatever it is, charter, that you can't join if you've got an ongoing dispute with a neighbor, which Ukraine certainly has, on dispute, which we'll have with that encroachment on Ukrainian territory. So what is to be done? I don't think we should at least not make it worse. I don't think these huge sanctions are going to have, bad knock-on effects, as I said. I don't think we should sort of go further. I think we should, maybe the best thing to do is, it sounds horrible to say, it is nothing.
Refugee assistance.
Of course,
Yes.
But the effects are really incalculable now. The refugees pouring into Europe. I mean, the last time, and there's talk of letting Ukraine join the EU. I doubt that's going to happen, but the possibility of Turkey joining the EU gave us Brexit, so quite clearly. The port of millions of Turks and Middle Eastern refugees pouring into Europe is, maybe they'd be more benign towards Ukrainians, but I still think it would arise very dangerous reactions.
So I want to now turn to more of your book's focus, which is just really about the insanity of the military-industrial complex in this country, but also just how ineffective that the bloat that it creates is, right? I mean, there's been this growth in the dollar signs for the Pentagon, but we're actually producing less in, quote, fighting strength. Can you talk about that paradox?
Well, right. To me, you can easily understand it if you proceed on the premise that defense or military capability is not the object of the exercise. The object of the exercise is to make ever larger sums of money. And in that case, the system works extremely well, and it's going to work even better. They're talking about, in response to recent events, an $800 billion-plus defense budget next of FY23-24. So, what I argue in the book is that, you can understand, you can only understand why they do things the way they do if it is, that's the case. I just give you a couple of examples. I have a couple of chapters in there talking about why it is that the Air Force is determined to get rid of a plane which is extremely useful, the A-10 ground support plane, which defends troops, supports troops on the ground, something that is obviously needed, and wants to get rid of that in favor of a plane that doesn't seems not to work at all, or barely at all, the F-35, the most expensive weapons project in the history of mankind. Why would they do this? Why would they be so determined? And the, you know, the answer seems to be obviously be that one is extremely cheap and doesn't bring in much money, the A-10, whereas the F-35 is the principal program of the most richest and most sort of successful arms weapons maker and or arms maker in the history of the world, Lockheed. I mean, there are just myriad examples. I mean, one telling one, it dates back a little while, but the veteran, a Korean War veteran, once told me something I still think of as deeply shocking, which was the in the first winter of the Korean War, half the U.S. casualties were from frostbite. Why? Because they had very inadequate boots that wouldn't protect them from the bitter cold of the Korean Peninsula in winter. So he told me, he said, what we used to do was raid the communist trenches because they had very good boots. So we could, you know, we could protect our feet. And I used to, he used to think to himself, why am I from the richest country in the world robbing boots from the killing people to steal the boots from the poorest country in the world? And that was the reason, because it wasn't like there wasn't enough money for boots, because there was much more money in strategic nuclear bombers, so they couldn't have bothered to buy decent boots. We saw this again in the Iraq war, you know, when working class families here were going into debt to buy protective equipment, you know, body armor and night vision goggles and so forth, for their sons and brothers and husbands, because the military couldn't be bothered to supply them properly, because they were, you know, pissing away all the money on, you know, very esoteric, very expensive technology that didn't work particularly well or at all.
I mean, it's just that stuff is just so shocking, but at the same time it isn't, because you see this emphasis on technology in warfare, the precision of tech and of electronics and different kind of sexy new war machines, which clearly must also, one, they're the most expensive pieces to buy, and two, is probably not a coincidence in the rise of, say, drone warfare in this country.
Well, that's right.
Exerted by this country, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it's this whole mindset, which is, you know, based on the bottom, you know, really designed to supplement the bottom line, that that high technology, you know, is the way to win. That and the whole idea of you know, this sort of notion that you can, you know, they talk about net. Well, they, I think the phrase has gone out of fashion now, but they still think that way. Net centric warfare, that everything can be linked together, that you can have, so you have total situational awareness is the phrase, and, you know, total precision. So you can know everything that's going on and therefore hit the precise target, just like the same thing as sanctions, you know, and take out the vital cogs in the enemy machine. I mean, it's a very mechanistic way of viewing things. And, of course, in the process, it's enormously profitable because, first of all, no one sort of knows. I mean, you know, like the F-35, why is it so incredibly expensive? Well, one of the reasons is, you know, that, they've equipped it with all this software. I mean, 20 million lines of software, whatever. I mean, it's a flying, keep calling it a flying computer, so it can know everything that's going on, every conceivable threat to the plane and where they are and everything. But, you know, it's no one really understands. I mean, it fails all its tests, of course. You know, no one quite knows how that's going to play out in practice. So going back to I'd just like to go say, you say, well, you know, what should we do? One thing I hope which we will do, but I wish we wouldn't, is, of course, throw more money at defense in this country. This is, I mean, I tell a story in the book of someone I know was at a meeting a breakfast meeting for a fundraiser for a Republican congressman 2 days after Putin took over Crimea. And most of the people there were defense lobbyists. And I asked my friend, I said, well, what was the mood? And he said, I'd call it borderline euphoric. I can guarantee you there's euphoria among the defense lobby and the military industrial complex today.
It's sick. I'm reminded oddly of, and this is a bit of a silly comparison, but how, you know, in bathrooms when the sinks or the toilets are non-touch and like it's supposed to actually increase the efficacy of it. And in fact, all the technology that's imbued in these simple but necessary functional items in our life, and I guess you can apply this to the military, it actually makes it infinitely harder to operate the basic function of that item.
That's a great comparison. Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, God forbid we should go back to something as, you know, old-fashioned as turning a tap.
Right.
You know, that that's entirely correct. And then you can apply that analogy. Well, going back to the, for example, the A-10 and the B-1 bomber, I tell a story in the book about, you know, there was a call to attack an enemy, a Taliban outpost in Afghanistan. The A-10s were dispatched, and the whole thing, that plane is designed so that the pilot can actually see with his own eyes what's going on the ground, because he can fly low and slow in comparative safety. And the pilots reported, no, it's not a target, it's just a farmhouse and just a family. It was a B-1 bomber, sort of 3 miles higher up. And they, with their, you know, looking all fancy, they couldn't see out their windows, but they could look on the sort of TV screen and, you know, conclude on orders from someone else who was looking at a TV screen that this was an enemy target, and, you know, drop their bombs. And the A-10 people said, no, we're going home, we're not going to bomb it. The B-1 was happy to do it, and they blew apart one, you know, an Afghan family. I said it was one tiny atrocity among hundreds of thousands, but it tells the whole story.
So I'm curious if you could track for us this, the increase in this bloat and how it ebbed and flowed, but always grew over time. What were some of the markers in history that created an increase in spending for the sake of it, essentially, on these new technologies? And how did that work through the 20th century and then, of course, the major explosions in the War on Terror?
Well, yes, I mean, good question. So, I mean, I track in the book, it was a very interesting analysis done of the defense budget since 1954. And it emerged from looking at this by a couple of friends of mine who are very skilled, Pentagon veterans who were skilled statisticians, who realized that noticed that the defense budget has grown at a steady rate of 5% a year overall from 1954 to when they did the study, which was in 2018. It wasn't always 5% every year, but if you draw a curve, you know, it follows, it's a steady 5%. Occasionally it would go up and down, it would go down. And when it did, there was an immediate reaction, which led me to conclude that, the whole complex, the military-industrial complex, is like a sort of giant single-cell creature that exists only to, grow and ensure its own food supply. So when did it dip? It dipped, for example, at the end of the 50s, when Eisenhower cut the rate of growth. He wasn't cutting the defense budget. He was cutting the rate of growth. And there was an immediate reaction. The creature reacted with the missile gap. We've told the Russians, which was, of course, a total lie. They knew it was a lie. But we had the immense buildup of the early Kennedy years. Look at another example, the end of the Vietnam War, when actually the defense budget did go down. But, well, why not? Because, we just ended a major land war in Europe.
Although it's raised after we've withdrawn from Afghanistan now in present day, so there was no decline then.
Right, but it did dip. It did dip actually in the later Obama years. Not the budget wasn't cut, but the rate of growth dipped. That's the important line to look at. It's when the rate of growth gets restrained for whatever reason, then it reacts. And, you know, coincidentally or not, now we have an absolutely new, very warm, not so cold war with Russia. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to discount the, you know, very active participation of Putin in this. I do find it interesting that whenever there's a threat to the food supply, we instantly have, you know, some justifications produced for jacking it back up again.
Well, Matthew, have any further questions for Andrew? We really appreciate your time today, especially on a day like this. Thank you so much, Andrew Coburn. Everybody should go check out his book, Washington Editor for Harper's Magazine. It's called The Spoils of War, Power, Profit, and the American War Machine. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Great. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Ken Klippenstein will be joining us to talk about his piece in The Intercept. Be back shortly. Thanks for bearing with us, everybody. We were just figuring out the tech. We are joined by the great Ken Klippenstein. Ken, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, good to be with you.
Yeah. So you have an excellent piece in The Intercept that everyone should check out. Saudi-Russia collusion is driving up gas prices and worsening the Ukraine crisis. So, let's just start there, really, because what's interesting about how Russia's positioning itself right now, obviously it's exercising imperialism, but they're also shoring up relationships with China. They've been doing that for a few years. But what's going under the radar, I think, is this developing relationship with Saudi Arabia, which you write about. At the same time, MBS clearly hates Biden, doesn't want to deal with him. So there's a bit of a power struggle going on over oil. Talk a bit about that as the premise for your piece.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I think that we have a perfect storm of sorts in the Ukraine crisis, and everyone is focusing on the military component of it, which, you know, obviously is important, is a ground invasion. But there's a context to it that I think is being left out because of, you know, how vivid and shocking and horrifying what's happening on the ground is, which is the fact that oil prices are at an all-time high right now. And after Putin ordered troops into the separatist territories in Ukraine, oil shot up to over $100 a barrel. That's an all-time record, and it was already very high. There are a number of different reasons for that, but a major reason is that Saudi Arabia has declined to increase production. President Biden has asked him in a phone call to the king, high-profile call with the king, to increase production. They declined. He's asked MBS. He sent a high-ranking I think Treasury or a State Department energy official and his Mideast top official to Saudi Arabia to request this, repeatedly denied. And what's interesting about that is under the Trump administration, in both election seasons in 2018, during the 2018 midterms and during 2020, Saudi Arabia complied with Trump's requests in both directions to both increase oil production in 2018, going into the elections, which has the effect of decreasing gas prices. And, you know, anybody that, as an American, can imagine what effect that has in elections. and then in 2020 to protect the nascent shale industry, or the weakened shale industry as a consequence of the decrease in demand from the coronavirus pandemic, the Saudis actually decreased production to protect that. And so what we're seeing now is a much different posture with respect to the Saudis. They're suddenly not complying with these requests. The difference is that we have a Democrat in office.
And so do you think, do you ascribe that more to, like, one, even though Biden didn't even formally sanction MBS over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, it appears that he has a disdain for him as opposed to a more of a personal relationship with Donald Trump. And clearly, as you write, maybe someone's quoted in your piece saying this, that Putin and MBS seem to have a bit more in common than someone like Biden. Is it really what that boils down to? Some sort of vengeance and dislike or distrust of Biden versus Putin?
I believe so. And I think so does the president. During a town hall meeting last year, President Biden said that, you know, oil prices, he's trying to get under control, but that he kind of slyly alluded to certain somebody doesn't want to meet with him, and he's still not going to meet with him. And he himself connected these two things. Now, National Security Council, when I contacted them, they tried to backtrack. I think that there's a lot of folks in Washington that don't want to have the public discuss this relationship because a lot of ugly things come up, particularly the human rights record, Saudi Arabia. Perhaps the most prominent example being the murder and dismemberment of Washington Post and D.C. resident Jamal Khashoggi. But that's just that's a particularly shocking example. But there's all kinds of other awful stuff that folks in Washington, I don't think, want to come out into the sort of public eye because that's going to imperil this relationship with a oil kingdom that is very important to the sort of geopolitical system that D.C. elites want. But Biden, to his credit, mentioned it, whether this was intentional or his, famous ability to get his foot in his mouth and say things he's not supposed to. He discussed this, and I think it's very important. I think the public should understand this, because as we're seeing in Ukraine, this gives the Russians a very powerful hand when the Saudis refuse to increase oil production, because that has the effect of driving up the cost and value of oil, which in a number of experts that I quote in the piece says gives them a freer hand to do these sorts of things, knowing that the Europeans, for example, the Germans depend almost entirely on the Russians for oil. And as I mentioned, the Russians and the Saudis are, for the first time in history, the two biggest oil producers on the planet are working together. Saudi Arabia having Russia having been allowed into OPEC, into what's called now OPEC Plus. So they're literally, this is literal collusion by definition, to keep up oil prices. And it has the effect of strengthening Putin's hand in pursuing, policies like this that might otherwise be sort of difficult for someone like him to go.
And I mean, is the United States is the third in that top three of oil producers. So what is that? What kind of, if we had, say, Bernie Sanders as president, I wouldn't worry about this, but do you think this has the effect of someone like Biden maybe not nixing drilling projects to the degree that he might want to domestically in ideal circumstances, maybe not want to the degree that environmental activists would want him to? Does this result in a pressure to increase domestic oil production as opposed to, I don't know, just transitioning off of this substance that has essentially held our foreign policy hostage for decades?
Absolutely. One of the most common refrains I see from not just Republicans, but kind of oil traders, experts, analysts, they say, wow, great move with stopping Keystone XL. And they're blaming it on that. Now, that would be one way to solve the oil production problem or address it. But another one would just be to move towards alternative energy so that you don't have to deal with this awful, set of choices we have where we have to it's almost like the Saw movies or something. It's like, want to play a game? Would you rather, destroy the environment that sustains all life on Earth? Or would you like to kneel to the Saudis and let them get away with whatever they want to with respect to human rights violations? I think neither of those choices are good, and you should just move toward. And this is something Biden has said in that exact same town hall I mentioned before, when they asked him, well, what's the solution to this oil problem and the fact that, MBS doesn't want to meet with you? He says, we have to get off oil. And I think that's the reality.
So what effect does Germany's cancellation of Nord Stream have on this relationship? Do you have any reporting on that? What's your sense of how things will move forward?
it's kind of a, has a bidirectional effect. It not only will hurt the Russians, but I think it's going to be very harmful to the German economy and to the European economy. Europe has very limited indigenous or domestic oil of their own, and so they're really reliant on Persian Gulf oil, which we have overwhelming control of, in, you know, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, so on and so forth. But then also the Russians. So when the Russians cut that off, it could have a devastating effect on this new center-left government that has just been elected into power, and I think it's going to be a boon for the far right, who favor warmer relations with Russia. And I think that you'll see that sort of dynamic play out throughout Europe. So it could be very harmful for the European economy and the global economy, because, again, that's the second biggest oil producer. They're working in tandem with the Saudis. Cutting that off is no small thing. In fact, I was surprised that they went ahead and did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that was maybe why Germany was reticent at the beginning to to join in with the Biden administration's tough talk on Russia, which, you know, I was very skeptical of what the State Department was saying, but Russia did it. They invaded last night, or I guess early this morning their time. Something I wasn't aware of was how, well, it doesn't surprise me that someone like MBS is so thorny and mercurial, and like the way that he in your piece talked about how he was so pissed that he couldn't get a meeting with Obama at the end of his term. Is this maybe something that you would trace this kind of split with his vice president and now the president back to?
I think so. And it's sort of extraordinary because I tend to think of this stuff as more systemic. You know, Saudi Arabia represents a range of different interests. It's not just the crown prince. But in this case, the crown prince seems to be an intensely personal feud between the crown prince and Obama. Because in 2015, and you know, I first heard this from somebody who's in the intelligence world and has insight into these things, that sounded too crazy to be true. So I started looking into it and calling officials, U.S. officials that I know had been based in Saudi at the time, and they confirmed it, that in 2015, MBS was desperate for a meeting with President Obama. And in the context of a young deputy crown prince at the time, he hadn't yet seized power. He's trying to shore up his image within the country and try to look like he has the backing of the U.S. That can be a very important thing for someone in you know, a circumstance like that, where it's a, you know, kingdom and there's no elections, there's no democracy. You're trying to make yourself look like the toughest guy in the block, and that you've got the backing of other tough guys, namely the U.S., their most powerful ally. My understanding is that he requested repeatedly. U.S. officials said, you know, we're working on it, we're going to try to do it. He got impatient and said, well, you know, I'm sick of waiting for this. I'm just going to meet with the Russian president instead, if he's not going to meet with me, and maybe I'll send a message to the U.S. about, you know, how important I am. So he goes to meet with Vladimir Putin in 2015 at the sidelines of an economic conference. And lo and behold, after that, Russia is let into OPEC for the first time in history. And again, this is a huge realignment of two of the biggest oil producers in the world now colluding with respect to production decisions and being able to manipulate global prices. The importance of this, I think, is really hard to overstate. And unfortunately, there's been very little reporting on it.
Except for you, which is very welcomed. And I am curious, too, about your opinion on how the Biden administration has not yet redesignated the Houthis as a terrorist organization in the Yemen war and effective genocide that Saudi Arabia is a part of. That was something that Trump did out the Trump did when he was, you know, right before he left office. For people that don't understand what that does, when you designate the Houthis a terrorist organization, when they control a majority of Yemen, you block aid and funds from going to these regions that are being starved. And it's the poorest and worst area arguably on the globe right now because of this proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia and among others in that region. So what's your sense about how Biden's kind of lukewarm support for this atrocious human rights violation in mass in Yemen, even though he has basically still sent them weaponry, I want to be clear about that, for their defense. What's your sense of how that's affected the relationship as well?
Well, unfortunately, I think this got lost in all the Ukraine reporting. He reinstated some of those sanctions midway through yesterday.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, then I that definitely did get lost by me.
Yeah. And it's really heartbreaking because this is the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world today. You have the largest famine, you have a cholera epidemic, like which we haven't seen in a century. And really you're seeing in those two countries, Yemen and Saudi Arabia, the poorest country in the world in the region, Yemen, pitted against the richest country in the region, Saudi Arabia, enjoying the support of the most powerful military force on the planet, the United States, providing logistical and intelligence support until fairly recently. And it's not necessary. I think anyone in the military, doesn't matter. I mean, I've had conversations with people that are don't have my politics at all, very, you know, conservative. They're saying, how is this advancing our interests? This is senseless. I mean, obviously, there's the humanitarian component, but even just from a national security perspective, how is this benefiting us? And I can't find hardly anyone in the military who believes that it is. And so the question is, why are we doing this? Well, the Saudis wanted it. And if you talk to folks in the Obama administration, I think there's a sense that after the Iran deal, Obama sort of decided to wash his hands of it, look the other way and say, well, this is going to be a concession we're going to give to Riyadh because they weren't happy with the Iran deal, you know, hated enemies of Iran. And so, you know, however idiotic and pointless and cruel this war is, we're going to let them do it because we have to give them something. And now we're in year one of it. It's ongoing. There's no indication that it's going to end. The humanitarian crisis has gotten worse. And I think the point that this makes is that, you know, Biden has given the Saudis so much. And to what end? What is he getting out of it? You know, they're not listening to his requests for oil production. Why is he still selling them weapons, providing certain types of, they claim, defense support in this conflict and not pressuring them to end it? What is he getting out of it? Again, with the same military folks right and left, tell me, you know, how is this benefiting the United States interest? And I think humanitarian interest, I don't think it is.
Well, I couldn't agree more. But at the same time, it's just Saudi Arabia is essentially holding the U.S. hostage, while also it's like the abusive boyfriend trope. But now they're punishing you for complaining about it, essentially, and are still, but you're still dependent on them for whatever.
It's funny. I was talking to an intelligence official who is an expert in exactly this stuff, and he used the exact same comparison. He described it, I think,
as a bad
high school relationship.
Right. I mean, now you're just going to, the people are going to call me an intelligence operative.
Oh, well, we already knew that. So
you stop blowing, please do not blow my cover. Ken Klippenstein, amazing reporter over at The Intercept and friend of the show and of mine. So good to see you, Ken. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this today.
Good to see you again, Emma. Take care.
All right, folks. With that said, we are going to head into the fun half and we are going to be joined by Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton. But first, Matt, what's happening over on Left Reckoning, which was last night, as you yawn because you were probably up late doing it. He's changing his headphones.
Yeah, I was up late last night watching that live feed of Kiev. We added a shortened show last night because one Ben Burgess was in Austin, Texas. So David wanted to spend the night partying with him after his appearance on a certain podcast.
He revealed it already, you can say.
On Joe Rogan's show.
Yeah.
So we pre-recorded the show last night. We talked, we did go really deep though. We went about 45, we were just going to do a short show and then we pre-record it, but we didn't, like 45 minutes on these Elon Musk scandals, the like segregation one at the California plant, the drilling microchips into monkeys' brains and killing them, and using unimproved substances on their things called bioglue that leaches into their brain, and also how they're making Texas cops march around rounding up people who graffiti pro SpaceX murals. So Elon Musk is a bad guy. We did about 45 minutes or so on him. We also talked to Chase Woodruff about Colorado. We kind of doing a state-by-state roundup. We're not going in any sort of order. We did South Carolina once, and now we did Colorado, and talked about a few things, including a sick-out against a anti-CRT sort of push against the superintendent. And so very interesting show last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning. There wasn't a post game, but I did play Ultimate General Civil War on the Twitch stream after the show. So.
Yeah. Well, check that out. What's that new LARP game that's coming out? Elden Ring?
Elden Ring.
Elden
yeah.
Ring. I saw George R. R. Martin was involved in that, and like maybe I don't game at all, but that's something I might even consider. Can you do it on a laptop?
I think it's PS and PlayStation, but right. I mean, you'd need a very powerful laptop to run that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I need to get a gaming system. I've been putting it off, but I think like my boyfriend would love it, and we, you know, we'll see. I don't know why I'm talking about this right now. Regardless, we are going to head into the fun half. Oh, Binder's here. Great. Let's let him in. Hey, Binder.
Hello, Emma, Matt, Bradley. Is Brendan here yet?
He's not, but we'll add him when he is.
Yeah.
Ah, cool. All right. So, hello, guys. How are you all doing on this
terrible,
this very
day?
Interesting day? Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well. Anyway, we'll talk a lot about Ukraine in the fun half and some fun clips to balance it out as well. But what's happening over on Scam Economy and Doomed?
Well, on Doomed this past week, I did a live stream for Doomed on Tuesday, and I spoke with a local Portland activist who helped ID the far right wing shooter who shot over five activists in Portland protesting over the weekend and killing one of them, a 60-year-old woman. And you know, this is a story that was pretty much ignored by the mainstream, and when it was covered by outlets such as Reuters, they oddly framed the story as an armed homeowner clashing with armed protesters. And while Portland PD took a very long time IDing this individual, the far right shooter, they did end up arresting the person on the protester side who was armed and did shoot back. And that person has been exonerated. They've been released. All charges dropped because they were indeed defending themselves and the protesters from an armed right winger who accosted these protesters and shot and killed one of them for basically no reason other than he didn't like them for their politics and they were in a general area near his neighborhood. He's not a homeowner. This didn't happen on his property, in his home, whatever sort of weird framing they tried to give it. This was literally a right-wing mass shooter that left an individual dead. And I talked to an activist to break down exactly what went down there. And, you know, it's many different facets to this story. Sure, you'll see the protester who was the good guy with the gun, who shot the bad guy with the gun. I'm sure you'll see him all over right-wing media and NRA and all the Kyle Rittenhouse lovers will applaud this guy too, I'm sure of it.
Well, he likes Rittenhouse, so there's that. And Andy, no. We talked about it on the show,
and
too.
We talked about that as well, yeah, with how this guy's a big fan of Andy Ngo especially. And Andy Ngo is the one who gave the coordinates and the whole protest map out on his Twitter account to let every one of his fascist followers know that, hey, these people who are fighting for justice for a black man who was killed in a no-knock raid in Minneapolis, go harass them. And someone did, and harass them is not the least of what they did.
Yeah, right. It's the woman.
That's his job.
Yep. We have Brandon. Oh, hello. Now you are, I can see you. How are you doing, Brandon?
Oh, you can see me too. Oh, I'm doing all right. How are you guys doing?
Doing all right. Insane news day. We'll be getting to a lot of clips. I'm not sure, guys, how many calls we can get to. I'll probably get to one or two, but I think we have a lot to talk about. So that's going to be the primary thing we're focusing on the fun half. Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse? Sorry to ask you this, because who knows if a new episode's out or not.
No, actually, we've been doing great this month.
There we go.
I mean, great by our standards, not great by like professional media standards. But no, we'll have a new episode out theoretically this weekend as well. You know, it was my birthday this week, so I've been just relaxing.
So is Bradley's. Bradley's birthday's on Saturday. When's your birthday?
My birthday was yesterday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Pisces gang.
That's right. That's right. All your preconceived, I don't know if they're the preconceived notion about Pisces tripping over their words, but if that's one of them, all that and the rest are true.
Yeah, I read that in some newspaper somewhere. All right. Mm-hmm. We are going to head into the fun half. Guys, I totally forgot to do this all week. Please, you know, come to the live show. If you haven't got your tickets yet, it's gonna they're gonna be sold out soon. I haven't even checked. They might be. So definitely click on it and check. Go to our website and you can totally find those tickets, both March 26th here in Brooklyn, May 15th, right? In Boston. Check those out. 646-257-3920. Maybe we'll take your calls. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a, whoa, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflakes says what? Snowflakes says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.